In northern Vietnam, one sees thousands of bomb craters marking its earth. With bare hands, the Vietnamese turned these bomb craters perpetrated by B-52 bombers into hydraulic systems, which have been able to trap flood waters coming from the Red River when the waters recede. One can see this even along the highways entering from the Hanoi airport. Some have been turned into fish ponds where it was possible. No capital outlay was needed to construct irrigation networks the way millions of dollars have been expended in the Philippines. If you recall your Dauchon, this is an example of daring to struggle to turn a bad thing into a good thing. In your discussion of the political culture of Vietnam, you overlooked the massive efforts in education being undertaken by the government of Vietnam. There has been a nationwide movement to raise the level of education, specifically in the South. Thousands of Vietnamese have been sent to train, mainly in the USSR and Eastern Europe, some to Japan, to the Philippines, to Malaysia, and a few to the United States. Given the thrust in education, Vietnam is preparing the ground for future takeoff. I will now come to the second part of my comments, which is on the foreign relations of SRV. His analysis of the relations between the SRV and its Indochinese neighbors, that is Laos and Cambodia, is good. I will not dwell on this topic, but I will just add one point of interest which is related to the economic survival of Vietnam. SRV's military action in Cambodia could also have been impelled by economic consideration. The SRV could not stand for long the hostility of the Pol Pot group, who had threatened to disrupt Vietnam's reconstruction efforts since 1975. It did not give them a breathing space since the Khmer Rouge decided to adopt an independent foreign policy from that of SRV. Agricultural production was disrupted in Tainin as the result of the border skirmishes in 1977-78. I doubt that the foreign policy of the SRV lacks an economic consideration to guide its decision-making. However, the most important consideration for this military action in Cambodia, as you correctly pointed out, is the fact that democratic Cambodia would constitute the weakest flank in the defense of the Indochina Peninsula. For the Vietnamese, Indochina must be protected from hostile forces, even at the cost of international censure, not to mention criticism from the socialist camp. This, to my mind, is the Achilles heel of the SRV. As regards Professor Pike's digression on ASEAN-Vietnam relations, I get the feeling that he dooms whatever attempts by individual ASEAN government for a rapprochement with SRV. You must have discerned from Indonesia's and Malaysia's statements in 1976 and 77 that their governments were willing to assist SRV in the reconstruction effort in Vietnam. Or even the Philippine government has expressed in early 1983 of its desire to accommodate SRV despite its criticism on its military action in Cambodia. This trend of forging a modus vivendi, to my mind, transcends ideological disparities, more so searches for means whereby these states live in harmony. Culturally, the ASEAN peoples and Indochina had historical ties that can be cultivated to forge a meaningful interaction. In contemporary international relations, these states, whether communist or capitalist, must continue Song's interferences to search for a viable relationship where respect for each other's political ideals and cultural beliefs must be the basis for interaction. Your discussion on SRV-China relations is good. I will not dwell on this. Part three of this paper I consider important, but the conclusions are far from satisfactory, primarily because they end by saying that we will not be able to make some educated guesses on what policy changes may come, since, as you say, and I will quote you, we do not know which individuals standing in the wings will take the reins of power, unquote. Are you saying, Professor Pike, that if Lee Zuan and company shall be exiting, so will their policies? If the pragmatists shall have taken power, a possible reversal of policy shall take place? This, I believe, is too simplistic. It might be fruitful if we pay attention how concretely Marxism-Leninism is practiced in Vietnam and the surrounding geopolitical influences moving Vietnam. To put too much emphasis on the charismas of the various personalities in Hanoi might be expecting too much from a secondary phenomenon.
Wow, Mili, that was a broadside. I think before we entertain questions from the rest of the group, I think we ought to give Dog Pike a chance to make some comments on Mili's comments. So, Dog.
I think there's only one area that we quarrel on, and that has to do with the nature of Marxism-Leninism in Vietnam, its quality, its characteristics. I'll come back to that. The economic failure in Vietnam since 1975 that's described here is, I try to stress, a post-war phenomenon. I recognize that there are a great deal of war damage, although it is not the lunar landscape syndrome that many people ascribe to Vietnam. But the malaise that developed and the statistics that are listed are all post-war. The rice production went down beginning after the war. The trucks and buses that were redlined, percentage of them, down after the war. The number of percentage of factory operations down after the war. For about 6 or 7 years, people in Hanoi were having less rice to eat during 76, 77, through the 70s than they had at the worst time during the war. So I'm not talking about wartime damage, which has not been rectified. I'm talking about economic malaise and economic deterioration that is strictly and entirely a post-war phenomenon. But that's a relatively minor issue, I think. Almost everyone would agree, including the Soviets, that Vietnam is an economic basket case. The question is, how do you rectify this? How do you lift Vietnam by its economic bootstraps? In the last year, they appear to have been making some progress, and rather impressive progress, in terms of rice production, mostly by taking their hands off some of the more odious controls. But our real quarrel, I think, has to do with the nature of Marxism-Leninism, a very fundamental issue. When I wrote Viet Cong, I had my background had been Soviet studies, and I'd immersed myself in the study of Marxism-Leninism. And when I was back at MIT writing the book on the Viet Cong, I assumed, really, that what made these people tick was Marxism-Leninism in some variant or some form. That was going to be the last chapter. And I can remember the great dismay I came, having finished the rest of the book and began going through the materials I had for this, and realizing that Marxism-Leninism as an explanation for mobilization, for motivation, for organization, just didn't hold up. It just was not there. And I I was left with a feeling of what the hell am I going to write about it? If what I assumed was true about Vietnam isn't true. This is a very complicated question, but I think the point that I would make, or my perception of it, is that Marxism-Leninism en route to Asia, and this would probably include China too, underwent a kind of transformation. Marxism-Leninism as a doctrine in Moscow is a body of knowledge which you are to absorb. You are theoretically infallible in interpreting historical phenomena if you have done this. Marxism in Vietnam is an icon. You hang it on the wall. People, and I have known Viet Cong who would say they would live and die for Marxism-Leninism. And yet you would say, are you a member of the party? Yes. Do you believe that the history of all hitherto existing societies is the history of the class conflict? They'd say, well, I don't know what that means, but you'd explain it, and they'd say, no, I don't think that's true. And you tick off historical materialism, dialectical materialism, all the tenets of Marxism. And for most part, they would reject this. And he would say, how did you get into the party? You had to pass an examination. Yes, the cadre told me in advance what the questions would be and what the answers would be. You say, and you don't consider that immoral? No. I don't know how many times. You do not have to know anything about communism to be a good communist. As I say, that's quite different from the view of Marxism-Leninism as a problem-solving device, as a tool, which is carried in the West. Now, you can argue that they're not good Marxists because they don't know anything about it, but it's a ridiculous argument. But what I am saying is that Marxism as an influence, as a determinant, as a force in that sense, as opposed to Marxism as an icon, is totally different. And it's a very serious mistake to try to interpret Vietnamese phenomenon in terms of this is the way Marxist-Leninists do it. It's been too much permeated by Confucianism and Taoism. It's been too savaged by experience. It's been too modified by the Chinese influences, Maoism and its variants. Only other point, and all I can do is reiterate this question of economics and influence. I do not believe, and I don't think there's any evidence at all, that you can use money to buy Vietnam off. The Americans could never do that in the South. The Russians or the Chinese could never do it with the North Vietnamese during the war, and they have not been able to do it since. Now, maybe ASEAN or Japan or someone else is going to be able to come up with this, but with a method that you can do it. But all I can say is that you've got history working against you.
Well, I'd just like to add before I throw the floor open for questions is that the Vietnamese character lends itself to Marxist doctrine because the Vietnamese have always looked for a categorical answer to the problems of man and the universe. This is why so many Vietnamese embraced Confucianism, and after that, a few Vietnamese embraced Catholicism because of the categorical dogma of the Catholic Church. And so Marxism-Leninism provided another creed. But they harnessed it to nationalism. I covered the last stages of the French struggle in 1954, and I had many friends among the Viet Minh. As you know, Viet Minh means Vietnam Doc Lạc, Dong Minh Hoi, and that means the National League for the Liberation of Vietnam. And of course, as everyone here knows, they never used the word Viet Cong to refer to themselves. That was an American and Saigon invention. They really referred to themselves as the National Liberation Front. And this is why nationalism was married to Marxism-Leninism, to provide an impetus for the struggle. Having said that, let me recognize Mike, who's been waving his finger for the past 15 minutes.
Slightly less, but never mind.
All right. I stand corrected.
Thank you very much, Chairman. Without fundamentally disagreeing with what Douglas has said, I wonder if I might add a slight gloss on the basis of a very limited experience in Vietnam recently. But first of all, let me touch on this issue of the creative application of Marxism-Leninism. What struck me in Vietnam in discussing key central issues of security was the total absence of Marxist-Leninist concepts and idiom in the analysis. Among everyone that I spoke to, and in fact, I had to ask, what does Marxism have to do with the way in which you analyze this problem? And I didn't get a satisfactory answer. The issues were discussed essentially in terms of national security, which is a matter of the highest priority, so I was told. Now, the first point that I'd like to raise concerns the reasoning of the people in Hanoi. I'm not disputing the likelihood of a sense of traditional entitlement, but I think that what's important to understand in terms of the way in which the Vietnamese look at the conflict in Indochina is the extent to which the issue of the political identity of Kampuchea is directly related to the security of Vietnam itself. It has to be stressed, irrespective of the other factors that are involved. And I think that their view is that the independence of Vietnam cannot be taken for granted. The country has a peculiar geographic structure, which makes it vulnerable to interdiction. They have fundamental problems integrating the North and the South, where the Americans brought about a cultural revolution. The role of China and Pol Pot in collusion, as seen from the point of view of the Vietnamese, was an enterprise designed to undermine the independence and the unity of Vietnam. And it's for this reason that they see it to be absolutely necessary that they should exercise a close influence over Kampuchea, not necessarily expressed in the form of an alliance as such, but they do insist on terms like political solidarity and special relationship. And I think it's for that reason, in part, in addition to many things that Douglas said, that for them the issue of Kampuchea is non-negotiable, because the independence of Vietnam is non-negotiable, and they do not see the two things as separate. Now, Douglas also raised the issue of optimism and suggested that there was a conservative radicalism which did not look on the bright side of things. Well, it's interesting that alongside this conservative radicalism, which I don't deny, optimism was a word which was used in Hanoi. Now, why optimism? Optimism, that is, in terms of the conflict in Kampuchea. First of all, because they argue that they are no longer on the rack. They are no longer faced with the same critical circumstances of 1979-1980 in economic terms. Secondly, they claim that there has been a revival of the Kampuchean people, and that, of course, is a controversial point. But in addition to that, and this, of course, only reinforces Douglas's point, there is a fundamental conviction in their own sense of fortitude, their own ability through stoic behavior to overcome all odds on the basis of their proven record. And clearly, from their point of view, when you consider the kinds of odds against which they faced and struggled in the past, it is not surprising that they think that they can manage this particular conflict. Now, finally, on the prospect for political change and the likelihood that with the passing of the current generation of leadership, the Vietnamese are likely to be slightly more flexible. Certainly mortality is going to bring political change, but I'm not so optimistic on this particular point for the reason that those senior leaders in the age group of late 50s, early 60s, who are going to move into the highest positions, are joined with the present top leadership in terms of a common shared experience of struggle, arising from the fact that for the Vietnamese, national liberation was a process which took 30 years. And we're not talking about a successor generation which is faced with the problem which arose in China of how to pass on experience and how to combat a decline in revolutionary verve and fervor. We're dealing with, in terms of experience, people of the same generation, even though they're younger in terms of age. And it may well be that their experience has been a more intense one and that their outlook is even more blinkered than those whom they're going to succeed. So for this reason, which may well be not necessarily proven, I'm not necessarily optimistic. Thank you.
Can I respond directly about geography? I don't know where Mike has studied his geography, but if you look at the map of Indochina and you think in terms of the geographical imperatives of Vietnamese security, I, for the life of me, cannot see what Kampuchea has got to do with Vietnamese security. I could make out a case for the juxtaposition of Vietnam and China. I can make out a case for the juxtaposition of Laos and Vietnam. But I cannot and Vietnam. Now, having said that, if you grant Vietnam its geographical imperatives of its security, Cambodia has almost as long a history as Vietnam. Why cannot you give the Cambodians their geographical imperatives of their security?
But actually, Colonel, I studied geography in the same place as you did, in London.
Is that all you have to say, Mike?
No, it's not all.
Would you like to say something else?
Not all I have to say. And I think that Colonel's point, your point is well taken, and it should be addressed to the Vietnamese. All I was doing was passing on views which I'd gleaned in Vietnam, and the point about geography was made, that's all. And I thought it was worth bearing in mind.
Well, I made the point that I think we should also hear what the Kampucheans may be thinking.
Of course.
Yes,
let me just one more thing.
Address the chair when you are... That is, otherwise becomes a dialogue between just the two of you.
Yes.
Mike, one last point.
I won't say anything again during
this. Because I see a couple of hands raised.
Explanation is not the same as justification.
That's it. Okay, Ambassador Chawat has asked to raise a question.
Yes, I wanted to intervene in the earlier session with Professor Vanandi, but I shall do it now. Concerning the paper prepared by Professor Mike, I tend to agree, except I'd like to qualify that when he made the presentation, he forgot to say that the Vietnamese went into Cambodia in order to get rid of Pol Pot, but not because of Pol Pot's brutality, but for other reasons. For the comments made by Mila, I have very strong reservations on many points, I must admit. And I'm grateful that Professor Santu made the point he did concerning the security of concern of Vietnam. On Mila's comments, I just wanted to mention that, in her views, she seems to think that the Vietnamese would be content once the security concerned would be satisfied after taking over Cambodia. And also that they perhaps went into Cambodia because of economic consideration. Perhaps it could be useful to remind ourselves that in the last years of the before 1975, one also were thinking about Vietnamese in the term that once they have taken over the South Vietnam, they would stop and reconstruct their own country. Well, they did not stop and they went on. So this is a general observation. Concerning the resolution of this Cambodian problem, which is also one of the topics that should be mentioned when we talk about the Vietnamese, I just wanted to reemphasize that within the ASEAN countries, what has happened, especially since March 1984, and the meeting that the ASEAN foreign ministers had in Jakarta in July 1984 and subsequent meetings between the foreign ministers up to this point have confirmed that the ASEAN stand as one as far as the thrust towards finding a solution, political solution to the Cambodian problem is concerned. Comments made by the academic circle, I would qualify. I'm very glad that they are not in the government. Otherwise, the unity of ASEAN would not perhaps be revealed. But of course, this is an academic exercise, and I'm very glad to have this opportunity to participate. But in order not to allow you people to go back and have misconceptions as to what we think, I'd like to emphasize again that this common approach is one. But I'd like to take this opportunity, since I've read Professor Vanandi's paper that he presented in Hanoi, and I've never had the pleasure to have a chat with him. And now that he's here, I'd like to take this opportunity to throw some questions at him. The question that has been in the mind of many people outside of ASEAN particularly is that Indonesia, and now the Philippines, of course, is voicing some concern or some views which perhaps could be a concern to us, but it's coming from the academic circle. The question is that Indonesia has been perhaps thinking about adopting another approach, and Professor Pike has mentioned this, we cannot buy the Vietnamese out. Yeah. And the question, the fact that they have allied themselves with the Soviet Union has been a decision made by themselves. Nobody has forced them to do so. And to bribe, I would perhaps use that word, to bribe them out of that embrace would, in my view, would not work. So we are faced with this dilemma that since they are determined to follow the policy they have been following for the past 6 years, and we on our side have announced our position, we have made known the ways and means that by which we should seek a solution to this problem. But still, the paper presented by Professor Vanandi in Hanoi, and we'd like to be honest about it, it has caused, it would not be honest if we were not to admit that we were not disturbed. We were, and the statement by General Mudani was also disturbing. But what has happened is that privately, General Mudani, and I stand corrected by my Indonesian colleagues, privately with our commander-in-chief, with our military people, who have on several occasions undertaken bilateral visits at armed forces level, have conceded that the Vietnamese constitute a threat to Thailand. So it contradicts the statement that he made in Hanoi. But just to perhaps have the presence, benefit of the presence of Professor Vanandi, I'd like to ask perhaps to expand on his thinking. In reading your paper, I have the impression that you feel that a different approach, other than what we are now doing within ASEAN, could perhaps make the Vietnamese change their policy. You're talking perhaps about try to woo them out of their present position and eventually perhaps if you reach a compromise on Cambodia. Now, I'm not very clear as to what kind of compromise you have in mind and what would be the concessions that the ASEAN would have to give. I must reiterate that our position is not a rigid one. What we have been devising within ASEAN has been one which is trying to accommodate the security interests of Vietnam. We are aware that the Vietnamese have security interests. However, the method by which they do want to preserve this security interest is not to the interest of particularly Thailand. So perhaps if I could be allowed, Mr. Chairman, to ask Mr. Professor Vanandi to comment on the views that he has expressed earlier on. Thank you.
Oh, you want to say something about that, Yusuf?
No, I just would like to, because this is a topic on domestic issues, you see, and that's why, can we refer that maybe to the day after tomorrow, because there's a special session on ASEAN and Indochina, especially on the conflict on Cambodia. Yeah.
Well,
if you don't mind.
Maybe just to have a taste, because...
I have to start to explain that we need another session, that is the problem.
Well,
We are running short of time. If you agree, we will extend the session to 6:15, but even then, we only have about 37 minutes or 28 minutes left.
Maybe it's relevant that it should be discussed tomorrow, but it's also within the context of the Vietnamese thinking as viewed by Professor Vanandi in as far as Cambodia is concerned.
But he may take up half an hour explaining what he meant.
All right.
Hanoi, actually.
Maybe tomorrow then.
That's the problem. Well, there's a couple of hands raised back there. Let's ask the gentleman from behind first. He was first, and after that you. This is Mr. Chung My Lee, who is part Vietnamese and part Cambodian.
I have no microphone, so I take the chair of Dr. Pike. First of all, I take this opportunity to thank the organizer, you know, giving me the chance to speak. It's just a few remarks only about Vietnam, because I was born in South Vietnam, so I think that I can have some, you know, clarification about the Đấu Tranh and so on. In the Vietnam problem, or in, you know, what people say about Vietnam, there are percentage of mystification inside, and that the percentage of mystification must be demystified. I'm sorry that I will upset you, Dr. Pike.
Second time.
In one way, you know that what you said, just you said that the leaders in Vietnamese leaders in Hanoi view or have the conception of the world in the pessimistic way, but just the opposite. They don't see the world as, you know, unreliable, but they are themselves unreliable. I think that may I call you my brother, Mr. Maximo?
Surely.
you used a lot of words against the Vietnamese. I used to do that too, and I hope that